K-Pop Podcast is sponsored by Pharma, where the 140,000 researchers with America's biopharmaceutical companies are finding new cures and treatments for diseases like hepatitis C, HIV, and diabetes. Visit GoBoldly.com.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Cape Up. Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States, is now the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. He's targeting key races around the country in the hopes of setting conditions for fairer redistricting in 2021. We get into what's at stake in Georgia, the controversy over his kick 'em comment.
When they go low, we kick 'em.
And his views on Kanye and what President Trump should have done. Hear it all right now. Former Attorney General Eric Holder, welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to be here, Jonathan.
So before I get into the conversation I want to have with you, I do want to get your reaction to the murder of our Washington Post opinions colleague Jamal Khashoggi. How damaging is the administration's reaction to America's standing in the world? And how damaging is it to our institutions at home?
Well, I'd say that the reaction of the administration so far has been distressing. To not come out in a more forceful way against that which I think everybody could see from the beginning was a murder and has now been admitted to have been a murder. We'll have to see, you know, what the investigation actually shows, who ultimately is responsible, who's held responsible for it. But I think the administration's response has not been as fulsome as it needed to be. You know, Secretary Pompeo going over there and that photo op was not something that I think was appropriate.
And how damaging is it to our institutions at home that an American resident who's a journalist writing for The Washington Post, one of the nation's preeminent newspapers, can go into a consulate and be murdered?
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievably distressing. It's something that the administration needs to focus on. And, you know, when the president says things like the press, the enemy of the people, when the president goes to Montana and celebrates the fact that, you know, a sitting congressman who was then a candidate body slammed and punched a reporter and ultimately pled guilty to doing that in a criminal context, that when you celebrate those kinds of things, when you say those kinds of things, you potentially put at risk reporters, and you certainly put the United States on the wrong side of the interaction of the media with the regimes that they're trying to cover.
So the last time you were on the podcast, you were just starting the redistricting effort. You're the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Now you're about to have your first test case with the midterms. You've been traveling around the country. What are you hearing on the ground?
Well, I'm hearing that people are really enthused about this election, that people are concerned about the ways in which the things that they're going to have to go through in order to cast a ballot. I think people are legitimately worried that although the enthusiasm level is there, that there are going to be barriers put in place for people to get to the polls. We've certainly seen that in North Dakota. We have seen that as well in Georgia. And, you know, this is consistent with what the Republicans have done over the course of the last decade with the gerrymandered power that they gave to themselves after 2011. They have put in place these unnecessary photo ID laws and other things that have been attempts to keep people away from the polls.
Can we talk more about Georgia? Because everyone's talking about the story of the 53,000 applications that are sitting on Brian Kemp's desk, have a hold on them, so they may or may not be able to vote. And he's the Secretary of State of Georgia, but he's also the Republican gubernatorial nominee. How is that even – how's that legal or even ethical?
Well, that's like LeBron James being in a game for the Lakers and saying, I not only want to wear number 23 and be a player for the Lakers, I also want to wear a referee's jersey. And I want to make sure that I call fouls and make determinations about the conduct of the game while I'm still a player. So it seems to me that what Secretary of State Kemp needs to do is to resign. He needs to step aside and let somebody else serve as the acting Secretary of State as long as he is a governor, a gubernatorial.
What if he doesn't do that? I mean, is there any recourse?
Well, you know, we still have the courts, and lawsuits have been filed to try to make sure that the election is conducted in a fair way. But the reality is that the courts are reacting to things that the Secretary of State will or will not do. And the better thing would be for him to simply take himself out of that office.
Did you hear the story about the African-American churchgoers who were on the bus and they were going to go vote? And I was out of the country when this happened, but... And but people were saying, have you seen this story? Do you know the details of that? Like, what happened there?
Yeah, I don't know all of the details. All I know is that you had a group of senior African-Americans who wanted to go to the cast a ballot. They were in a bus of some sort. And then at some level, I think at the local county level, a determination made that at least they said out of consideration for their safety, they were turned back. And it's that
consideration for their safety.
For their safety. That's what they said. Now, and that's the kind of thing that worries me. Things that are kind of neutral on their face, concern for senior citizens in transportation, can be used as a ruse to keep African-Americans away from the polls. And, you know, when you see things like photo ID laws, they are kind of neutral sounding on their face. But the impact of them, the disproportionate impact that they have on African Americans is something that you always have to keep into consideration. In the same way that, you know, a poll tax seems like it's kind of, you know, neutral sounding. Literacy tests, again, neutral sounding. But you knew what the impact of those mechanisms was on African Americans, keeping them away from the polls. And so we see these modern day techniques, again, with the aim, the intention of keeping people of color away from the polls.
Also, how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap? All those ridiculous tests meant to keep African Americans from voting. You know, I keep thinking about the Supreme Court decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act and Chief Justice Roberts' rationale that, well, we don't need this anymore because basically racism's gone.
Right. It's time. You know, I'd like to speak to the five members of the court who gutted the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County decision and ask them, what do you think now? I mean, what do you really think now on the basis of what you've seen happen in a variety of states, inconsistent with what you said, Mr. Chief Justice, with regard to what you thought where racism was in this nation? I think that, you know, Justice Ginsburg really had it the best in her dissent when she said, you know, just because you have an umbrella over your head and that keeps you dry in a rainstorm doesn't mean that you should, you know, take the umbrella away, because if you do, you're going to get wet. And this, what we have seen post-Shelby County, I think, is totally consistent with what the minority in that decision predicted was going to happen.
So as part of the NDRC, you're targeting 12 states for November 6th. There's 10 gubernatorial races, 19 legislative chambers, 4 ballot initiatives, and 6 down-ballot races. These are very specific numbers, very exact numbers. Why? Why focused on these particular races?
Well, what we wanted to try to do, we did a 50-state analysis. And what we tried to do was to say, let's try to figure out where we can have the greatest impact, the biggest bang for our buck come 2021. And so we identified 12 target states. We identified races within those states, all with the notion of putting in place people who would be critical to the redistricting process in 2021. Governors always matter. State legislators always matter. But again, if you go state by state, you'll find that the state auditor in Ohio really has an outsized influence with regard to redistricting. The state secretary of state in Ohio, sometimes Supreme Court justices, certainly in Wisconsin and in North Carolina. And so we have picked those races.
You had a success in Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
You got involved when we talked back in February. You were just about to go to Wisconsin to campaign for one of the judicial nominees.
Right. We've had a number of successes in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We supported when Scott Walker did not want to have called special elections to fill two state senatorial seats, people who had joined his cabinet. We sued him, won there, then filled those seats with Democrats. And then we also campaigned successfully for a woman who was running for an open Wisconsin Supreme Court seat, Rebecca Dallet. She was elected first time a Democrat has been elected in an off-year election for Wisconsin Supreme Court since 1995.
Hmm. So keep going. I interrupted you with my Wisconsin interjection. But again, pick up on why you're focused on these very specific.
Because we want to make sure that come 2021, we have at the table making the decisions on how the lines are drawn, the people with the greatest amount of power. Again, governors, state legislators, people in different positions in different states. But we're only trying to have a fair process. I want people to understand this. This is not an attempt to gerrymander for Democrats.
I mean, Democratic is in the name.
Yeah, and maybe we should have done a better, you know, job of coming up with a name. It is the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. But really, this is, from my perspective, a partisan attempt at good government. We want to have a fair process come 2021. And if we have a fair process, I am really confident enough of the people who we are supporting, Democrats, the policy positions that Democrats and progressives are taking, that we'll do just fine in that process. And, you know, I think one of the real tests of that is that we, that is Democrats, are saying that we ought to take this out of the political process altogether, that we should have in place these independent commissions.
Sort of like California.
Yeah, they have them in Arizona and in California, and we're supporting four ballot initiatives in Michigan, Missouri, Colorado, and Utah that would create independent commissions there and do the redistricting in that way. And take because in too many places now we have a situation where politicians are picking their voters instead of citizens choosing their representatives. Now, this is something that the NDRC supports, and I think that's in some ways the biggest indication of us wanting a neutral process. I've not heard any Republicans come out in support of these independent commissions, other than Arnold Schwarzenegger. To his credit, he has been campaigning for this.
Can the California model and the Arizona model actually work in other places? I mean, do other states actually have the political will to follow in the footsteps of those two very different states?
Yeah, I think they certainly can work, and the political will is certainly evidenced by the fact that in Michigan, for instance, they had to have, I don't think, 400,000, 500,000 people to put the ballot and sign up to put the initiative on the ballot, and they had, I don't know, overwhelming, they went well past that 400,000 or 500,000 number. So this is something that that the people support when they are made to understand that unfair redistricting has an impact on the gerrymandering, has an impact on their day-to-day lives, whether it has to do with, insane gun safety measures, reproductive choice, climate, gerrymandering, voter suppression. People get excited about having control put back in their hands and making sure that their representatives reflect their desires.
So we've got to talk about you were down in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Were you down in Georgia for NDRC, or were you there for Stacey Abrams, the gubernatorial candidate, or both?
Both. I was there for NDRC in support of Stacey, as well as in support of the legislative candidates who we have decided to support in Georgia.
And it was there that the comment, the video seen around the world, where you said when they go low, we kick them. You did say you did not mean anything inappropriate and anything unlawful or illegal, but it did just sort of take off like wildfire. Republicans in particular saying that you were being uncivil. So do your critics have a point, or do you think they're desperate?
No, they're desperate, and they're trying to come up with a distraction. What I said there is what I feel, which is that I'm going to be tough. I'm going to be strong, and I'm going to forcefully oppose any person or any organization that wants to undermine our democracy, and that we have to be mindful of what Republicans are doing, whether you look at what's going on in North Dakota, what's going on in Georgia, and we have got to be forceful, tough in our responses to that. And so if they decide that they want to do inappropriate things, we have to make sure that we fight them in every way that we possibly can. Now, and the reaction to it was something that was, generated this fake outrage by Republicans. It's really kind of amazing to hear Republicans talk about we need more civility.
I mean, really.
in our politics. So there is that. But I think what they're also trying to do, and what the president is trying to do, is to make sure, tell voters, look over here. Don't look at, this tax cut. That this is supposed to be their chief legislative achievement.
Right.
And they don't want to talk about it.
They don't talk about it. They're not running on it. They're not doing commercials on it. In fact, there are more commercials from Republicans about health care,
right,
and how they say they want to protect pre-existing conditions.
Right. They say they want to protect pre-existing conditions, and yet I think it's 20 Republican states are now suing to repeal Obamacare, mm-hmm. that would take these pre-existing condition protections away from people. They have no alternative to it, but they know that they've gotten caught. They see that the American people care about the protection against pre-existing conditions being a factor in the health care insurance determination. And so now they are trying to glom on to this notion that they care about pre-existing conditions when, in fact, they don't. Because if they did, they wouldn't have brought this lawsuit that Scott Walker and other governors are supportive of.
The K-Pop Podcast is sponsored by Pharma. Where the 140,000 researchers with America's biopharmaceutical companies are finding new cures and treatments for diseases like hepatitis C, HIV, and diabetes. So here's to the fearlessness to fail, so success can follow, and to the patients helping to find the breakthrough that might save their lives, and perhaps one day, yours. Welcome to the new era of medicine, where together we go boldly. A message from America's biopharmaceutical companies. Visit goboldly.com.
Here's the thing that that's sort of confusing to me. So we've gone through all of this craziness with the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh, the president's crazy incendiary tweet of the hour, and yet the polls that are out right now show that his approval rating is up. And in fact, now it is 2 points higher than President Obama's approval rating was at this point in his presidency. Why do you think his approval rating is going up when, just by all objective measures, if you believe your lying eyes, you would think that he would still be mired in the 30s, if not lower?
Well, with all due respect to those people who conduct polls, I remember 2016, and as far as I know, that number that you're talking about is reflected in one poll. Now, he has seen, I think, an uptick in his popularity, I guess, over the last, couple of weeks or so. But the test will ultimately be what happens on November the 6th, because I think November the 6th is a conglomeration of things. There are certainly local issues that are going to have to be decided, but it's also a referendum about the direction of this country and the stewardship of this country by this president. And it'll be interesting to see how we look at the election results on November the 7th. Mm-hmm. That, I think, will be the ultimate poll.
I want to go back to the whole fight thing, because over the weekend I moderated a very interesting panel with Kathy Griffin, the comedian, actress who got into a lot of trouble over a photograph that she had of President Trump, and Michael Avenatti, who is the lawyer of Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, who is all up in President Trump's face at every given moment, giving as good as he's getting. And he said at Politicon that Democrats need to be willing to fight Trump. And I'm paraphrasing here. And he said that if you don't fight him, you'll never get the chance to govern. And that sort of echoes the point you were making in Georgia, no?
Yeah. I mean, we have to take on this president. We have to take on this Republican Party. We have to be proud to be Democrats. We need to be forceful in advancing, you know, these great Democratic ideas that we have to serve the people. We have to be proud of our history as Democrats. You know, Democrats were and still are and will continue to be the party of the common man, the common woman. And, you know, there shouldn't be any half steps about this. This is not a time for triangulation. This is a time for us to be strong in our defense of Democratic Party principles.
We had the president of Common Cause here talking about something that I don't think most people knew was even a thing until we brought it to their attention. And that's the idea of a constitutional convention that, you know, conservatives in particular have been pushing on the question of a balanced budget amendment. But as was discussed, once you get a constitutional convention going, all hell could and most likely will break loose. You know about this. So are we being hyperbolic here in the concern?
Well, we've never had a constitutional convention. And so God only knows what could happen if one were called. But if one were called, that convention could essentially consider anything. And, you know, they say they're concerned about a balanced budget amendment. They could, you know, put amendments to the Constitution that deal with every conceivable aspect of American life. That's why the process up to now has always been to consider an amendment to the Constitution point by, you know, amendment by amendment, as opposed to just opening the whole process up and really subjecting our Constitution to, you know, wholesale revision. That prospect scares me. Mm-hmm. I don't think, and is one of the reasons why I would be opposed to a constitutional convention. On the other hand, there are specific constitutional things I think we need to consider. For instance, limiting the number of years that a Supreme Court justice serves. You know, we have life tenure now. I think they ought to serve maybe three senatorial terms, 18 years. Unelected people serving for 30 years, that I think is too much power in an individual, especially when that person doesn't have to face the voters.
How damaging was it that Justice Kavanaugh's 45-minute response to Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, how damaging was that to the Supreme Court and also the notion of the independence of the judiciary?
Yeah, I thought that was extremely damaging, both for his, I thought, his nomination and also writ large, the legitimacy of the court. I mean, that statement that he made about, you know, the left wing coming after him, I guess the Clintons coming after him, revealed a partisan side of a person who now sits on the United States Supreme Court. And that gives me concern. You want to have the court to be seen as a neutral and detached component of our government. And I think he revealed himself to be quite partisan in his views. We'll have to see, you know, what he does as a justice, how the court deals with the variety of questions that it undoubtedly will have to consider during his time on the Supreme Court bench. But that his revelation of himself during the confirmation hearings is something that gives me great concern.
Now, when you were Attorney General, and even after, you always said that LGBT equality was the civil rights issue of our time. And the New York Times is now reporting that the Trump administration is looking to define in law gender identity and basically making it clear that whatever genitalia you're born with, that is the sex by which you will be identified. I would love to get your reaction to that.
Well, you know, the question is why? There's no hue and cry out there that this position needs to be advanced. I think this is really just a naked attempt at trying to create a wedge issue, an issue that for whatever reason the president and his supporters think might be politically advantageous to them. It is inconsistent with, I think, you know, if you look at the polling of the American people, they're supportive of you know, LGBTQ equality. This would take us back, and you know, I think it is something that is, it's not anything more than a political attempt by this administration to divide us as a people.
I've said many times on the podcast, on television, in writing, that the Parkland kids, it seems as though greatness jumped 50 years, that we had the John Lewis generation, the Malone generation, and now we've got the generation of Emma Gonzalez and the Parkland kids. Am I wrong to think of them that way? Just the sheer activism that they showed right in the middle of tragedy and on, to me, is still awe-inspiring.
No, I think it is inspiring, and I think it's the thing that ultimately gives me hope. These are young people who are committed to civic activism, who are going to be responsible activists who care about this nation. And it might be, you know, gun safety measures that brought them together, but my sense is that they are going to be concerned about a whole range of issues. And these are young people who are not, who don't carry the baggage that, you know, that my generation necessarily carries. And so when we're talking about LGBTQ issues, I think they're in a fundamentally different place than generations before them. I think that they're going to take this nation in a progressive direction. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see the Republican Party trying to hold on as best they can with all of these gerrymandering efforts, with these unfair voter efforts, because they see that the future is slipping away from them, and they want to hold on to the past, the power that they generated in the past, by any means that they possibly can. And so that's why they use all of these electoral means to hold on to power that is not deservedly theirs.
Okay, we have to talk about this,
mm-hmm.
Eric. We have to talk about him, Kanye. What was that?
You know, It was painful to watch. He was used by the president, and I'm not as critical about him as I might be if you look at just his words, which are just crazy. I mean, repealing the 13th Amendment, all those kinds of things, because I think that he's a person who's sick. I mean, I really do think that. I do think that he's a person who's battling with emotional disorders, you know, mental disabilities. And so I temper my criticism of him with that in mind. But to see the president of the United States there listening to that with cameras, you know, all around him is an indication of who this president is and the lengths to which he'll go to exploit, individuals for his own political purposes.
Was it surprising to you that, one, this meeting happen at all in the Oval Office in front of the Resolute desk, but two, that the president of the United States didn't take one look at what was happening and think to say, hey, you know what, Kanye, come with me. Let me take you into my private office. No one is ever in there. And let me show you all my TVs and just pull him out of the situation and call an end to it. And yeah, instead, he didn't. I mean,
that would have been an empathetic thing to do. That would have been a kind thing to do. But I think we have seen that this president doesn't necessarily have any degree, the normal degree of empathy that you'd have, or the ability to assess a situation and see it from anything other than his own perspective. It's, from my perspective, I would have seen, a young man, a talented artist who is in distress, and I would have done exactly what you suggested, find some way to, you know, kind of call it off and say, well, thank you very much, Kanye, for sharing, you know, what you have shared with us. I just want to continue this conversation in private, and let's step out of the Oval Office and have a further conversation in my private office.
So you have thought about things in a manner of, now, if I were president of the United States, this is how I would have gone about it. So, what you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking right now, November the 6th, that we need to have people come out and vote all over the country, certainly in those 12 target states that we are focused on at NDRC. November the 7th, I will really start to focus on my decision about whether I'm going to run for president. As I've said in the past, I think I'll make up my mind early next year.
Mm-hmm. And what's on that checklist of things? And this is a serious question, because this is a serious thing to consider. Running for president isn't just, it's not some hobby that you do for 2 years of your life and, you know, pray for the best.
Right.
There's serious considerations involved. So give me the top three considerations.
Well, certainly family considerations. I mean, this is something that would involve not only me, but members of my family as well. And so I need to make sure that this is something they would be supportive of. I've also got to make, do a self-assessment and make sure that I feel confident that were I to run, that I could offer up solutions to the problems that this nation is still confronting. And then make a kind of, just a political determination. Do I think that I could generate the necessary support to win? I wouldn't go into this with the thought that I simply wanted to make a statement. I would only go into this with the thought that I could win. And so those are the kinds of considerations that I think I'll have to go through, after November the 6th. So everybody get out there and vote on November the 6th.
And one last question on this. So if you were to get into the race, you wouldn't be afraid to fight President Trump. Like, he sends out a tweet, he attacks you on the stump. Are you gonna ignore him, or are you gonna go out there, go toe to toe?
You got to be strategic. There are certain things that you're gonna ignore, but there's an awful lot that you have to simply push back on. He's from Queens, I'm from Queens. He's from New York, I'm from New York. I've dealt with guys like Donnie from Queens before. And, I know how to handle guys like him. And so to the extent that he would come after me, you wouldn't respond to everything, but there are going to be certain things that he would throw at you that you would have to push back on. You don't want to get down in the gutter with him at the same time. You simply don't, turn the other cheek. Somebody, tries to get at you, you get back at them.
Eric Holder, former Attorney General of the United States and Chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, thank you very much for coming back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.